Chapter 2. The Cripple and the Atheist. Section 1. "Now that you're here," said the cripple, "I want to talk things out. I'm in the depths of depression. You realize my position, don't you? I am done in. There's nothing to look forward to but lying on my back like a helpless log for the rest of my life. Cheerful prospect, isn't it?" The atheist sat down by the bed. He had climbed up from the hotel in the town, at the foot of the mountains, where the three of them had been staying since the night in which they had carried their burden into the monastery. He was the eldest of the party, the one whose face had recalled some memory to Brother Anselm. It was certainly a face that would not be forgotten easily. Its singularity lay not so much in the straight features, startlingly handsome though they were, or in the blackness of the eyes, but in the peculiar, cynical twist of the mouth. It was a clever face, revealing a powerful personality behind. "I am sorry," he replied. He passed a hand over his hair. The cripple began to tell him what the monk had said on the previous day. Mother Anselm had talked quietly to him later on. He was calmer now, and could speak collectedly. The atheist listened. The cynical twist of his mouth became more marked. "Oh, yes," he said, as the other came to an end. "But I am afraid this good monk's argument sounds somewhat unconvincing. These religious people have got to say all that. It's their profession, their job. Did his apologies for the Almighty convince you?" "I scarcely listened. I didn't want that kind of stuff. It bores me stiff." "I'm not surprised. Apologies of this nature are apt to be wearisome, and forced." There was a weariness in the tone, as if he were feeling his way. He crossed his legs. "These people, you know, call their god a god of love." His manner was indifferent. "So I believe," said the cripple, equally indifferent. The atheist went further. "Can you seriously imagine a god of love creating a world like this, a world whose pains and horrors give the lie to anything suggesting love?" The cripple looked interested. "I can't say I've ever thought much about it. Go on." The atheist moved forward his chair. "Can you believe in a god who is eternally silent to the cries of tortured humanity? Can you believe in a god who looks down upon the world in cold aloofness, who never shows himself, who never makes a sign? Can you really believe in a good god creating men and breaking them on the wheel of life, as he has broken you? If there were a day of judgment, it would be for man to appear at the bar not as a criminal, but as an accuser. If I were ever to believe that a god of love created this world, from that moment I should consider myself insane." The cripple was roused now. "What sort of god created it, then?" "We've no reason to suppose it was created at all. It's always been going on." "But how? Something must make it go on." "Certainly. Some sort of eternal energy. A blind force." The cripple pondered, staring at the wall opposite. "Well," he said at last, "supposing there is no god. Supposing I'm the victim of a blind force instead of a god. I don't see that I'm any better off than before. It doesn't put me right. It doesn't help me. Can't you see? I'm caught, pinned down. I can't escape. Oh, hell, can't you see, man?" The atheist hesitated.
"You mean you want something to live for?"
Yes. "If you can give me something."
"Listen. Live for humanity. Put the idea of God away. The day is coming when men will no longer cringe before a god in a distant heaven in a future life. That idea has had its run. It is man now. Humanity. Let humanity be your god. The future is not in another world. It is here. There is a dazzling future ahead. On earth. Science. Genius. All the powers of human reason are even now uniting in the only cause that matters. The future of mankind. Soon the whole world will be dominated by one sentiment, one idea, the reign of man. Man no longer crushed, but conquering, chaining the very forces of nature, casting out disease, riding down roughshod all that is hideous and ugly. There is a heaven coming. It will be of man's own creation. It will be this world transformed. The future lies with man, not God.
But I shan't be there, came testily from the other.
No, but the memory of you will be, of your share in bringing it about.
My share! A bitter laugh broke from the cripple. Can you see me transforming the world on my back?
The world will be transformed by the spread of reason, the steady progress of reason, by the rooting up of false ideas, of medieval superstitions, by teaching men to rely on themselves and not on an imaginary God, to concentrate solely on this world, on this life, not an illusory future invented by priests, in a word, by spreading truth. Why not study the works of reason? You have a clear intellect. Why not use it? You will have leisure. Even on your back, you will have abundant opportunity of influencing others. Combat these false ideas. Why not further the cause of humanity by...
Oh, hang humanity! Excuse me being rude, but I haven't the slightest interest in it, or its future. Humanity can get on without my luminous intellect to enlighten it.
Intellect? I'm not a fool enough to be taken in by sop like that. Even if I could do what you suggest, even if I did share in bringing about this wonderful future, what good would it be to me? I shouldn't be there to enjoy it.
You and your work would live on in your fellow men, said the atheist.
And am I to spend my future non-existence in oblivion of that consolation?
How very comforting!
Thank you, but I'm afraid the prospects of humanity don't appeal to me on those terms.
The cripple thought. Then he said,
I don't wish to seem ungrateful, but,
may I be quite candid?
Certainly. I rather wish you were. Remember, I have merely suggested one course.
Well then, you give me, if possible, even less to live for than before. If there were a God and a future life, there would be something to hang on to. You say there is not. You take that from me. You know too, forgive me, being quite plain, you know quite well that in your rationalistic scheme of things, I could never be anything but a burden to others, to humanity. I am helpless, smashed up, useless. I am one of those ugly things you mentioned that ought to be got rid of, scrapped, thrown into the dustbin. You know quite well that I, and all life's miscarriages, are on your list marked unfit for further use.
Rather a bald way of putting it, but still, if you feel...
The atheist purposely left the sentence unfinished. The cripple regarded him curiously for a moment before he continued.
You once spoke to me of your utilitarian ideas, eugenics for the human race. The unfit were to be weeded out. The old, the sickly, and the crippled were to be offered, politely offered, euthanasia. It should be gently but firmly impressed upon them that they were clogging the activities of their fellow beings, that they were in the way. I remember the very illustration you gave. A marching army hampered by its wounded. Life, you said, was essentially the vanquishing of the weak. The unfit must drop out. Humanity march on. And I agreed with you then, when I was wanted. I am one of your unwanted now.
And do you agree now? Cut in the atheist.
He had shown no sign of embarrassment. He was watching the cripple intently.
I don't know.
The cripple paused.
I don't know.
He looked up, to be met by a cold, calm stare.
Suddenly a fury seized him, and for a moment he saw red.
He held himself in. Then he said deliberately and calculatingly, I don't know, but there is one thing I do know. I asked you for something to live for. You offer me, you don't say so, but it is what your ideas mean. You offer me the choice of burdening the world with my broken body or of getting out of the way. You offer me death for preference, and after death, extinction. You take away everything and you give nothing. I asked you for something to live for. You offered me nothing to die for. The atheist looked out of the window.
Section 2. There was an odd look in the cripple's eyes. He had lain there very still, after the atheist's footsteps had echoed his departure down the corridors of the quiet monastery and died away. The evening had faded slowly into night, into the vast blue canopy stretched above the alpine heights. There was silence in the night. There was silence in the heights. Silence in the valleys. Silence in the monastery. Silence in his room. A bell pealed into the deeps of it all, and into the cripple's brain. He stirred uneasily, and then became aware of things, of the door opening. Brother Anselm stood before him. He felt himself being raised. A cup of something was placed on the bed table. He began to drink, mechanically. Brother Anselm seemed to be watching him. "Don't stand there looking at me," he snapped out. Brother Anselm sat down and began to say his office. When later he was removing the empty cup, he said, "You've something on your mind. Won't you tell me?" The attempt was greeted with a laugh, a bitter, sneering laugh. The cripple lay still again, staring unseeingly at the wall. "Good night," said Brother Anselm. The cripple took no notice. There was a puff at each of the candles, and then darkness. Suddenly, he became alert. He listened. He heard the door shutting. He waited. Then, slowly, painfully, he shifted his body to the side of the bed. His hand felt downwards, underneath. The knapsack was there. He tugged at it. It was on the bed, his fingers feeling for the straps. He tore at the canvas and plunged a hand inside. Yes, the case was there. He wrenched it out. The knapsack fell with a thud. There was a little button. The lid was open. His fingers ran over the row of files. It was the shortest one, he remembered, the one the chemist had warned him of. That was it! He drew it out and held it up. Yes, that was it. He could see it silhouetted against the open window. The moments went by. He was still holding the little phial, eyes staring into the blue silence without. Would it be more silent than that? Was the atheist right? Would it be just a blank? Suddenly he felt afraid, horribly afraid. The terror of that nothingness gripped his whole being and set the pulses drumming in his temples. The little bottle slipped from his fingers, now wet and shaking. He clutched wildly and recovered it. Then, slowly, his will reasserted itself. He lay still. The little silhouette appeared again, and fingers feeling for the cork. There was a swift movement somewhere in the room. Something, a hand, was gripping his wrist. He felt his fingers being unloosed in a steady, deliberate way that suffered no resistance. The bottle was released. He fell back, stupid and dazed. There were more movements in the darkness. A match grated and flared. The candle flame hesitated, grew, and revealed Brother Anselm! It was some 10 minutes later. The cripple was calmer, but the twitching of his lips betrayed the strain of the recent crisis. Brother Anselm had not spoken. He had merely flung the phial out of the window, picked up the knapsack, put the case inside, then sat down and resumed saying his office. "How did you know?" The monk looked up. "I saw it in your eyes." There was another pause. "How did you get in?" "I never went out." You were here all the time?" "I was." Brother Anselm laid his breviary on the table. "There are only 3 people who know what happened just now. You and I and God. It is only known to those 3. You understand?" Yes, said the cripple. And then he added, "Thank you." Brother Anselm did not pick up his breviary again. He looked at the clock on the mantelpiece and then sat rather intent, as if waiting for something. It came. Through the open window, there floated, rising and swelling and sinking, the strong cadence of the monk's office. De profundis clamavi ad te. Do you know what that means? The cripple shook his head. Somehow he could not speak. From the depths I have cried to thee. The cripple looked away, rather queerly, as if not wanting to be seen. His lips tightened and quivered. A spasm shook him. A jerking, difficult spasm of sobs. And then the floodgates of his soul gave way, and down the pallid cheeks there streamed an agony of tears. Brother Anselm was by the bed now, his hands on the pathetic heaving shoulders, a world of pity in his voice. Oh, my man, my poor man, my poor man.